This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Many countries, high-income countries, were surprised by the pandemic because they have been investing in medicine, in secondary, tertiary services, specialties, subspecialty services. But their investment in primary health care, in public health, the basic public health, was really minimal.
That was Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, World Health Organization Director General, about lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic. Details coming up also. Abdulhamid Dabiba has been sworn in as Libya's interim prime minister. And children as young as 11 are being beheaded in Mozambique, according to Save the Children. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Libya's new interim prime minister was sworn in yesterday to lead the war-torn country's transition to elections in December after years of chaos and division. Abdulhamid Dabiba declared this will be the government of all Libyans and Libya is one and united. The UN Security Council on Friday called for all foreign forces to leave without further delay. Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis in London, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi what is doable and what is not through the unity government.
New Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dabiba has really achieved quite a lot since he was the Prime Minister designate about a month ago. He has had meetings with constituencies in the East and West. He's met General Khalifa Haftar. He has met a range of civil society leaders. I think he's being a little bit optimistic when he says Libya is one and united, because there are two or three governments and hundreds of militias and a rogue army in the country at present, and the institutions function differently in different parts of the country. But maybe he's the man because of his business background and kind of nonpartisan perspective to begin to unite Libya. So I want to give him a try and let's just see what he can accomplish.
The UN on Friday called for all foreign forces to leave Libya without further delay. Parliament Speaker Aqila Saleh called for unification of state institutions and pulling out of all mercenaries. Would the government of unity be able to achieve these two goals?
Well, those are two very big goals, and these things have been called for since 2014, since the Tobruk-Tripoli split happened. There have been some positive signs of late on the getting mercenaries out of Libya, and that's that the Russians and Sudanese withdrew from CERT prior to the HOR meeting there to approve the cabinet list. However, the Russians didn't leave the country. Russian mercenaries just simply went to their base in Jufra and are likely to go back to CERT now that those meetings are over. The Sudanese are largely withdrawing for their own domestic Sudanese internal political reasons. And Turks who are in the country are official army personnel and are not mercenaries, and they're not likely to leave. So the 23 October 2020 ceasefire declaration had a provision that troops needed to be out by January 23rd. And that hasn't happened. So I'm not really sure that the government has the power, because the mercenaries and foreign troops are much more powerful than the security forces of Libya. On the question of state institutions are kind of outside the purview of the government, because in Libya, the central bank and the NOC and the Libyan Investment Authority and GCAL, the electricity monopoly, are semi-sovereign and they don't answer to the government. So I'm not sure how the unity government can achieve that unless it plans to reform the entire economic model of Libya or appoint new heads of those semi-sovereigns in line with what's called the Buznica process.
Prime Minister Dabiba jumped into his role even before his inauguration, including pledging to combat the coronavirus crisis and taking anti-corruption measures by freezing state-owned investment funds. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I saw that announcement too, and it brought a big smile to my face, because Dabiba has come into office under many bribery allegations, and his family has been mired in all sorts of corruption allegations, both in the UK and Libya and Malta, so that his first thing that he would announce is that he's going to take anti-corruption measures, and freezing state-owned funds seems very rich. But of course, it makes sense because he wants to divert attention from all of the allegations around him and saying that he's going to take on corruption seriously. I don't understand what any of that means from an implementation perspective, because the Libyan Investment Authority, which is the state-owned investment sovereign wealth fund, that's already frozen. So what other funds does he mean to freeze? And combating coronavirus, Libya has essentially done nothing to enforce lockdowns or to have a coherent testing or vaccination program. So again, I need to see the implementation details. But of course, I agree with these proposals in theory.
So what are the prospects of unity government's success against the backdrop of armed militias and behind the scene foreign influence in Libya?
So although I'm quite skeptical about Prime Minister Dbeibah and the GNU's ability to take on things like corruption or unification of institutions, I want to give him the benefit of a doubt that he has shown himself more capable than others to make novel coalitions and novel alliances. So it seems possible that by carrot and stick, he might be able to get various armed militias to work together. He's not going to get them to disarm. That's not possible. And foreign influence is not going to decrease in Libya, but the government of national unity may have the ability to have novel alliances between different stakeholders. Like the Turks and Russians support opposite sides of the conflict, but they both want back payments. Maybe he's just the man to be able to get them their back payments, so they're willing to work together to see Libya progress towards a better future. And having a government in place is certainly better than having none in place.
That was Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute and founder of Libya Analysis in London, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed Al-Shenawi. Tunisia's President Kais Saied plans to visit Libya tomorrow to support the democratic path in the country. South Africa, so far, has given COVID-19 vaccines made by Johnson & Johnson to almost 150,000 health workers on a trial basis, but its official immunization program remains stalled. The country suspended its rollout of the AstraZeneca jab shortly before it was due to start a few weeks ago, when tests showed it was ineffective in preventing mild to moderate COVID-19. Now European countries are stopping its use because of concerns it causes blood clots. But the scientist who led the South African leg of a study that tested the AstraZeneca vaccine late last year says there's still a place for it, both in his country and globally. Darren Taylor has more.
Wits University infectious diseases expert Professor Shabir Mahdi projects South Africa's third wave of COVID-19 will start at the end of May, beginning of June. But he says the way things are going, with many citizens ignoring safety protocols and participating in mass gatherings, the viral resurgence will start as early as next month. South Africa's recorded more than 1.5 million coronavirus cases over the past year, and almost 52,000 people have died so far. Mahdi says the casualties are still being driven by a highly infectious variant first identified in the country in December.
Now, the other big unknown in terms of a resurgence is whether the virus will undergo even further evolution, which makes it even more resistant to the first generation of COVID-19 vaccines that are available. So all of those factors would really influence the timing as well as the magnitude of the next resurgence.
The scientist says it's uncertain when so-called next-generation vaccines will be available to successfully combat COVID-19 variants. Given this, he says South Africa and the world needs to reflect on the weapons it has to fight the pandemic and must decide what chances it's willing to take.
As an example, are we wanting to keep the high-risk groups unvaccinated, at least until the resurgence is upon us? Or do we want to take a chance of perhaps even rolling out the AstraZeneca vaccine, which from a biological perspective, there's every reason to believe that it will actually protect against severe disease, even if it didn't protect against mild infection. So the toss-up that we've got.
The World Health Organization is still backing the AstraZeneca vaccine and urging countries to administer it. Mahdi's adamant the shot should be made available to South Africans at high risk of getting COVID-19.
Leaving them unprotected until the resurgence is upon us essentially means that we are going to again suffer a massive number of cases as well as death from COVID-19. So I think it's important for us to reflect. And the bottom line really is an absolute need to recalibrate our understanding of the pandemic in terms of how we respond to it and our understanding of what we can actually achieve with COVID-19 vaccines.
Part of this recalibration, he says, is to accept that South Africa and most of the rest of the world cannot stop a constantly mutating COVID-19 using methods previously thought to be effective.
The notion of getting to herd immunity with COVID-19 vaccines, at least for this first generation of COVID-19 vaccines, is extremely slim.
Mahdi says the world's going to have to come to terms with a stark fact.
COVID-19 is not something that's going to go away, even if we have a next generation of vaccine. COVID-19 is here to stay for the rest of our lifetimes, probably. The focus really needs to be centered around trying to minimize severe disease and to try to reduce the number of people that die of COVID-19.
This, he says, can indeed be achieved through constantly improving vaccines. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
My Octopus Teacher, an underwater documentary about the touching but bittersweet relationship between a man and an octopus, had its directors feeling sky high after its nomination for an Oscar in the Best Featured Documentary category. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke with one of them in Cape Town.
Papa Ehrlich co-directed her first feature film with James Reed. It's about their fellow filmmaker, Craig Foster, who befriends an octopus and visits her every day. He also gets to know her home, which is part of a great African sea forest in the Atlantic Ocean. Ehrlich says she watched the Oscars announcement last night.
I feel like I'm just coming back down to earth now, 24 hours later. At the time, I jumped so high. I think I was higher than the table that my laptop was on.
She says the movie, which took 10 years to make and was eventually picked up by Netflix, has already bagged at least 20 international awards from various mainstream and environmental festivals.
The most amazing part of this film is the reach that it's got and the responses that we've received from people all over the world. Really just resonated with what we were trying to say. Yeah, so all of this is really just the cherry on top of the cake, but we are very, very grateful, very excited.
Ehrlich says the movie has done wonders for the non-profit organization she and Foster work for called the Sea Change Project. It's aimed at protecting the kelp forest, which runs along the coast of South Africa and Namibia and is under threat from climate change. She says they received many donations from the public, allowing them to continue the work they love.
So we really are just focused on doing what we do, which is to get into the kelp forest every day and record what we see and make this place a global icon and an ecosystem that everyone all over the world is invested in protecting.
My Octopus Teacher is up against Collective, Crip Camp, The Mole Agent, and Time. The winner will be announced at the 93rd Academy Awards ceremony on the 25th of April. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
Children as young as 11 are being decapitated in Mozambique. This according to the United Kingdom-based aid group Save the Children, which says the beheadings are part of an Islamist insurgency which so far has killed thousands and displaced more than 650,000. Since 2017, Mozambique's northernmost province of Cabo Delgado has been home to a festering insurgency linked to Islamic State that has escalated dramatically in the past year. The shadowy jihadists in Mozambique, known locally as Al-Shabaab, pledged loyalty to the Islamic State group in 2019. The United States last week declared the group a foreign terrorist organization. The U.S. Embassy in Mozambique in a statement yesterday said U.S. Special Forces will train Mozambican soldiers to help them combat the jihadist insurgency. Kenya has refused to attend a week-long hearing by the United Nations highest court over a long-running maritime dispute with Somalia. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more on the case from Paris.
The seating is open. The court meets today to begin
the maritime hearing at the Hague-based International Court of Justice, or ICJ, began with a conspicuous no-show. In a letter last week to the ICJ, the Kenyan government cited a mix of reasons for not participating, including the COVID-19 pandemic that it said made it hard to adequately prepare and make its case. The court's president, Judge Joan Donoghue, rejected Kenya's request to brief it before the start of Monday's opening.
The court regrets the decision of Kenya not to participate in the oral proceedings.
But she said the court had a raft of material previously filed by the country in arguing its side of the case. Kenya's dispute with Somalia centers on some 100,000 square kilometers of Indian Ocean waters, rich in fish and possibly also oil and gas. Mogadishu argues its maritime border with Kenya should be extended along the same southeasterly line as its land border. Nairobi claims a frontier should head in a straight line east. Over the months, Kenya filed several requests for this hearing to be postponed, along with other demands. Presenting his country's opening arguments, Somalia's Deputy Prime Minister Mahdi Mohamed Guled described the dispute as of key national importance to his country.
We hoped that it would be possible to settle our dispute with Kenya bilaterally through negotiations. Unfortunately, that proved impossible.
The maritime spat adds to mounting diplomatic friction between the East African neighbors. In December, Mogadishu announced it was cutting ties with Kenya for allegedly meddling in its internal political affairs. It may take years for the ICJ to rule on the maritime dispute. It has no power to enforce its rulings, and in the past, some countries have simply ignored them. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
COVID-19 has been a deadly wake-up call for the world, spreading quickly due to gaps in public health services and underscoring the need to keep science separated from politics. VOA Africa's Lenore Dumudu interviewed Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, World Health Organization Director General, about the lessons learned from the coronavirus.
I think one very important lesson is importance of investment in public health. When I say public health, it covers many of the aspects that we're saying now, which are very important for emergency preparedness and response. As you may know, and as you know, many countries, high-income countries, were surprised by the pandemic. Because they have been investing in medicine, in secondary, tertiary services, specialties, subspecialty services. But their investment in primary health care, in public health, the basic of public health was really minimal. So countries should really give attention to public health, to primary health care. And the other important lesson from the last 1 year is when politics and science is not aligned, there is a danger. In some countries, we have seen that the expert advice goes one side while the political decisions were going the other side. And that was actually helping the virus to spread.
Let's talk about how countries are experiencing COVID-19, specifically countries in Africa. Although the continent has not been spared by the deadly pandemic, Africa has seen less cases of infections and death compared to the rest of the world. What do you make of it?
I think the combination of many factors actually help. One, the population is young, so young population. And second, Africa actually started as early as possible. preparing itself and responding. So that early quick action really helped, that's two. And then the third is, the early action was not just individual country level only, but it was a continental-wide coordinated effort. That also helps. And the fourth is, Africa, our continent, is regularly challenged by many infectious diseases. It could be yellow fever, meningitis, cholera, Ebola, you name it. So the primary health care or the public health system is better prepared, so it can respond fast. So these are the four, I think, reasons that probably helped Africa to be better compared to other regions.
That was Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, World Health Organization Director General, speaking with VOA Africa's Lenord Moudou. Botswana says COVID-19 restrictions have not affected antiretroviral ARV supplies to its HIV-positive citizens abroad. The Southern African country with the world's third highest HIV prevalence rate provided free ARV treatment even to citizens working or studying outside the country. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
Botswana's Assistant Minister of Health, Sitomo Lila-Tidiswe, says the government continues to provide antiretroviral ARV supplies to its citizens abroad. More than 300,000 Botswana nationals are on ARV treatment, with some staying abroad. With COVID-19 travel restrictions, some patients have been unable to travel back home for refills. However, Lila-Tidiswe told Parliament those on treatment are prioritized.
Instead of coming back for routine refilling, Botswana working or studying abroad are able to access ARVs in their countries of residence. In case of those who, because of various factors, are obliged to come for refilling, my ministry has a special arrangement in which their significant others or relatives are allowed to collect the ARVs on their behalf and send them.
Non-governmental organizations like Botswana Network on Ethics, Law and HIV/AIDS, Bonela, had expressed concern over the impact of COVID-19 on ARV distribution. Some patients were unable to access medication due to restrictions, including lockdowns across the world. Irene Mpo, a Habron resident, says an HIV-positive relative studying in neighboring South Africa has been unable to return home for her monthly refills.
We have relatives who come regularly from abroad for refill. COVID restrictions have affected their supply, and we know that's not the best to skip ARV treatment. We hope the government does its all to ensure that they get this consistent supply.
Health experts warn that skipping ARV treatment could lead to drug resistance. Botswana provides free ARV treatment to its citizens and resident foreign nationals. One in every five people has the virus, meaning the prevalence rate is only behind that of regional neighbors, Eswatini and Lesotho. For VOA, this is Mgondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suwuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Bonkvili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music From bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito, the African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the